Have a seat. Oh, I'm so loud. All right. I was wanting to find some kind of illustration or story, and I just could never come up with anything. And then real life happened, and Monday, my son, my older one, who had worked endlessly to make the basketball team in high school, makes the team, has his first practice, comes home, kicks the ball around with Sawyer for a few minutes in the yard and rolls his foot and he can't walk on it. And I'm just like, there you go. And I've been studying these truths about God's providence and how he allows things. And I was so upset and sad. And Blake said, you know, I really can't be upset, Mom. The Lord allowed this to happen, so it's okay. And I'm like, so anyway, he's doing better, but it was just like real life reminder, these things, life always kind of has a way of showing you what you've been learning. But anyway, I'll go ahead and pray and then we can get started. Lord, thank you for today. Thank you for these ladies who are here. Thank you for this passage in your word. And I pray that you'd help us to be able to rule out all the distractions and just learn what you want us to from this. In your name, amen. Well, I think the story of Joseph is one of the most fascinating in all of the Old Testament. Every Christian needs to study this book again and again, because next to Jesus, Joseph may be the greatest example of godly character and integrity in the Bible. His life is evidence of the providence of God, and we can see that human history is at the hands of the God who is concerned about the smallest details, and that's true in our lives as well. The opening verses in Genesis 37 introduce us to 17-year-old Joseph. Follow along or listen as I read verses 1 through 4. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and he was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. So right away we see the animosity that existed in this family towards Joseph. His brothers, who are actually his half-brothers, hated him so much that they couldn't interact without hostility and conflict. And the presence of Joseph in the home didn't create the problems so much as reveal them. But God is going to use this hatred to send him to Egypt, where he will eventually save his people from starvation. No matter what the intention of people, either good or bad, God will bring about his own ultimate end. This reminds me of a great Susanna Spurgeon quote that says, "The soul that has learned the blessed secret of seeing God's hand in all that it concerns cannot be a prey to fear. It looks beyond all second causes, straight into the heart and will of God, and rests content because he rules." Verses 5 through 7 tell us Joseph was spoken to by God in dreams, which revealed one day he would reign and rule over his brothers, and in a future time his family would bow down to him. So not only do we see his brothers hate him because he was favored and loved more by his father, but now we add his dreams that seem outrageous to his brothers. And while we may not know exactly why he would say all this to them, the Bible never ascribes pride to him. He most likely was excited to hear from God and shared it in simple faith and humility. Yet the dreams fueled their hatred even more. And the beautiful coat that his father had made him caused jealousy and resentment, because anytime a parent favors a child over another, this is a recipe for disaster. It's not really surprising, though, that Jacob favored Joseph, because Jacob's life had been shaped by favoritism. After all, he grew up knowing what it felt like to be chosen by one parent and overlooked by the other. Favoritism is a cancer that grows and grows. The effects of Isaac and Rebekah favoring their sons Esau and Jacob set them up as adversaries to each other. So when parents show favoritism, it can fracture sibling relationships and foster resentment, and it's easy to repeat this cycle generation after generation without even realizing it's happening. It's also important to note the coat given to Joseph to wear, not only was it a symbol of the favored status, but it also marked him as the one chosen to receive the firstborn blessings. Keep in mind, his first son Reuben had forfeited his status by sleeping with Bilhah, and the next son Simeon had murdered the men of Shechem. Joseph was the son of Jacob's beloved Rachel, who was the only one he ever intended on marrying. So he might have reasoned in God's sight, Rachel's my first wife, therefore Joseph has the right to be treated as firstborn. In any case, Joseph was a godly man, and we see this in verse 2 when we're told Joseph had brought back a bad report about his brothers to his father. So whatever their sin was, it must have been extremely evil for Joseph to feel he had to tell his father. And while some have criticized him for being a snitch or a teenage tattletale, nothing in the text condemns Joseph for his actions. In fact, he should be commended because whatever his brothers were guilty of doing, we know that Joseph didn't participate. And just think of the situation. He's 17 years old, far from home, alone with his brothers, and he doesn't give in to the pressure to conform to their evil behavior. Joseph was godly and had higher standards than those around him. And what makes this so special is think of all he had going against him in life. His childhood was far from wonderful. It was very difficult. He had a family that knew about God but didn't always behave like they did, brothers who despised him, a domineering grandfather in Laban, an uncle in Esau that everyone was afraid would kill the entire family, constant rivalries among the four wives. His own mother died giving birth to his brother Benjamin. His young life was filled with pain, yet he turned out to be godly. And that should encourage us that just like Joseph, we can live a victorious Christian life and we are not in bondage to a difficult upbringing. God's grace is always sufficient. Nobody enjoys being disliked, but the rest of the story reveals God stood by Joseph and strengthened him, using him greatly. The jealousy, bitterness, anger, and resentment of these brothers ultimately reveal a sinful attitude towards God. They would be held responsible for the evil that they were going to do, and while God never approved of their wicked behavior, he's going to use it to work out his plan. Romans 8:28 comes to mind, doesn't it? God uses everything, including evil, mixes it together, and it comes out for our good. Verses 12 through 17 set the stage for Joseph being mistreated. His whole world is about to be turned upside down. Starting in verse 12, then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem, and Israel, or Jacob, said to Joseph, are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said, here I am. And then he said, please go and see if it's well with your brothers and with the flocks and bring back word to me. So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field, and the man asked him, saying, what are you seeking? So he said, I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks. And the man said, they have departed from here, and I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Sometime after Joseph had related his dreams to the family, we're told his brothers went to pasture the sheep in Shechem. And as you recall, this is the same area where their sister Dinah had been raped, and they had murdered the men of that community. So it might have been a little dangerous for them to be going in that area, and it could be because of the potential danger faced there that Jacob had sent Joseph to check on their welfare and report back. It does cause one to wonder, though, why would Jacob send Joseph alone, knowing their animosity towards him? Was he oblivious to the situation? Did he not understand the danger he was putting his young son in? Joseph was aware of his brother's hatred, yet he was obedient to do what his father told him to do. Verse 13 says, he says, I will go. And it was a long journey of about 50 miles. And it was this obedience that opened the door for him to be treated so hideously by his brothers. And what we must understand is that at times, due to our obedience to the will of God, we can find ourselves in painful situations. It's not because we're disobedient to God, but because we have obeyed him that we will suffer at various times. And the truth that I really want us to engrave in our minds is that God had ordained that Joseph would go to Egypt. And even though it took Jacob's insensitivity to his son's hostility and the murderous intentions of Joseph's brothers, God's sovereign providential hand was working to accomplish his divine purposes for Joseph, Israel, and ultimately the entire world. Even when those over us in authority are thoughtless, insensitive, or unthinking, we can trust God to be in control of the situation and use it for our good. When Joseph arrived in Shechem, he was told his brothers were 20 miles north in a place called Dothan. So in obedience to his father, he continues the journey until he found them. And it's this encounter with his brothers which was to forever change Joseph's life. Verses 18 through 33 tell us what happens next. Now when they saw him far off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer's coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him, and they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty, there was no water in it, and they sat down to eat a meal. And they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balms, and myrrh, and on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah says to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. Then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes, and he returned to his brothers and said, "He is no more, where shall I go?" So they took Joseph's tunic, killed the kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father, and they said, "We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" And he recognized it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." So Joseph's brothers had such deep-rooted hate and hostility that as soon as they saw him coming, which was not exactly hard to spot in that colorful coat, their immediate reaction was to kill him. Their anger over him built to such a boiling point that all they needed was the right opportunity to murder Joseph. Warren Wiersbe says, "The combination of hatred and envy is lethal. It simmers in the heart and waits for the spark that will set off the explosion." Among all the brothers that want to kill him, Reuben is the one who steps up to defend him and suggests, "Let's just throw him in the pit and leave him. That way he could go back later on and rescue him and return him to his father." So they go along with this suggestion, and the first thing they do when Joseph arrives is strip him of his robe, which represented everything they hated him for, a status symbol that reminded them their father favored Joseph and chose him to be the eventual family leader, and they were not about to let that happen. They want to prove his dreams false and remove any possibility that he will ever rule over them. They attack him, strip him of his robe, and throw him into a dry cistern. The pit was a bottle shape. The walls of the neck would be slick with no way to get out. And later on, it's interesting, in Genesis 42, we learn that he was pleading with them not to do this. 22 years later, their brothers remembered how they treated him. So while Joseph is pleading and begging for his life, they actually sit down to eat a meal. Imagine the callousness of these men. They pay no attention to his cries. Hearts that are hardened by hatred and thoughts of murder are not likely to pay attention to the cries of a victim. And while they go on eating, something significant happens. Spotting a caravan of traders on their way to Egypt, Judah suggests, "Let's sell Joseph as a slave. We can get rid of him and make some money in the process." So they sell him for 20 shekels of silver, which was the going price of a slave in those days. And I kind of thought when they hoisted him up out of there, he must have maybe wondered, did they change their mind? You know, am I going to be okay? And then only to be sold off as a slave. It must have just been awful. So he's taken down to Egypt by Abraham's descendants through Ishmael. He didn't have a voice in the trajectory of his life, but he didn't need one, because there was a God with all authority whose hand of mercy and grace was guiding every seemingly senseless step. And there are times when you have suffered or will suffer, and nobody seems to care. The people who hurt you will continue to live their lives as if nothing happened while you suffer in deep pain. And like Joseph crying from the pit, you will discover how horribly cruel and indifferent people can be. And you may wonder if God even cares or hears your cries. And the answer is yes. Think of it. Joseph is calling out to his brothers to spare his life. And God hears his cries of affliction and sent traitors to deliver him. Bring him to Egypt to raise him up, to deliver his people from dying off during a famine. Joseph couldn't understand it, but God was using the evil of his brothers to accomplish his plans for him. Let this encourage you that God is not indifferent to your cries. You may not understand how he will use something painful in your life for his good, but he is. So now Joseph's on his way to Egypt, sold as a slave by his brothers, but apparently Reuben must have been away for a little while because he returns and he's shocked to find Joseph missing. Verse 29 says he tore his garments. So he's in panic mode because as the oldest brother, he's responsible for Joseph's welfare, and now he's gone. So what will he tell his father? Reuben decides to join in with his brother's plan to deceive Jacob by telling him a ferocious animal killed Joseph. And it's ironic that a goat was what was used to kill, to dip the robe in its blood, because years ago, Jacob had killed a goat to deceive his father Isaac when he pretended to be Esau. And now he himself is the victim of deception. We do reap what we sow. Jacob had set an example of deception and scheming before his children, and they followed that example, and it came back to haunt him. So on top of the evil that they did to Joseph, now they commit more evil by lying to their father, seeing him mourn and refuse to be comforted, thinking his dearly loved son is now dead. What a contrast we see between the callous, wicked behavior of Joseph's brothers and the caring, concerned heart of Jacob. His grief was so deep, Genesis 42 tells us 20 years later, he's still grieving this death. And in the same chapter, verse 21, we're given a glimpse into the brothers talking to each other and just looking back and saying, we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet would not listen. Joseph descended from being a favored son wearing a regal robe of favoritism to being a kidnapped slave. His whole world had flipped completely on its head. Betrayed by brothers, all the security of home and his father's love violently ripped away from him. He must have wondered, how could this happen to me? I'm being obedient to my father. And he must have thought about the dreams and what they meant, since his brothers weren't bowing down to him, but had sold him off as a slave. Verse 36 tells us Joseph was sold again to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer. God sent these traitors at just the right time to the right place and made sure he was sold to the right person. Potiphar is the main guard of the greatest ruler in the ancient world, and he will eventually put Joseph in prison where he will meet someone who will speak to Pharaoh about him. And in meeting Pharaoh, he'll be elevated to the position of prime minister, and in that position, he will save his people from famine. There is so much to learn from this chapter, but I'm going to narrow it down to just three quick things. Number one, how God is using your circumstances can only be fully known by him. And our present struggles, even sorrow, is used by God, so don't lose heart. Submit to God's will, even in suffering. We can trust him for the outcome. And number two, this hits a little close to home. When it comes to favoritism among your children, it's easy to pull away from a child we find ourselves butting heads with continuously and battling attitudes, but this is when we must lean into that relationship and let that child know how loved they are. It's easy to play favorites without even knowing it. So be careful and make any necessary changes to correct showing partiality. And number three, even when circumstances seem completely unfair and you are mistreated, the Lord is perfectly in control and oversees every single detail in our life for our good and his glory. We move next to Genesis 38, and the contrast of Judah's story with Joseph is significant. While Joseph is suffering, God is working in other ways, preparing other key figures like Judah to fulfill his promises. And this passage is one of the more unusual chapters in the book. Some have called it distasteful and even bizarre. And the reason for this is the sexual sins that are included. You've got incest, prostitution, and a little bit of sexual perversion thrown in there. It's difficult for us to see how this story fits into the flow of Genesis. But in the mind of Moses, the author, this is Jacob's story. And the truth God wants us to know include Judah. This chapter not only tells us the story of Tamar, who desires to bear Judah's heir, it's from the line of Judah that our Messiah will come. But we see how God sovereignly overcame every obstacle Judah put in front of him to prevent this line from continuing. God will always overcome man's sinfulness to accomplish his purposes. He works through imperfect people like Judah. Verses 1 and 2 begin the story by telling us about the same time Joseph is sold into slavery, Judah leaves home and settles in a place called Adullam. And while he's living there, he met and married a Canaanite woman. And as a result of this, three sons are born to them, Onan, and Shelah. And in time, is a grown man. Judah selects a wife for him, and we're introduced to Tamar. Verse 7 tells us, though, that God took Ur's life in judgment for his wickedness. Whatever his sin was, it had to be pretty serious to be struck dead in judgment. Now, what would happen to Judah's line? In the custom of that day, if an older brother died without children, it was the responsibility of the next oldest brother to marry the widow and raise an heir that would be considered his brother's children. It was known as levirate marriage, and though it seems odd to us, it was very common practice at that time. So not only would it help the family because possessions would stay within the family, but it would provide stability and support for the widowed wife so she doesn't have to remain a widow and would be protected in society. And if you want to know more about this in detail, Deuteronomy 25 or the book of Ruth gives much better detail. But moving on, we read verses 8 through 10. Judah's second son, Onan, does agree to marry Tamar, but he didn't want to produce a child because apparently he might have wanted the inheritance for himself. If he had a child, it wouldn't count as his offspring, but the offspring of his deceased brother. So he continuously interrupted his sexual activity with her to avoid impregnating her. And for this wickedness, God took his life. This was a repeated action, and God judged him for his rebellion to the Lord's will to continue the line of Judah. Judah's sin began by marrying a pagan Canaanite woman. His children are wicked, the messianic line is threatened to end right here, and Judah goes and commits another wrongdoing. He should have had his third son, Shelah, become Tamar's husband, but at the time of Onan's death, he was a little young for marriage, so Judah, who had the responsibility to take care of Tamar, says, go back to your father's house, wait till he grows up, knowing full well he had no intention of giving his third son to Tamar. He thinks she is bad luck, and everyone who marries her dies young, so he sends her away. Don't call us, we'll call you. We're done. So he breaks his moral obligation to give his son to her. His fear of not wanting to lose Shelah, his son, caused him to rationalize his thinking, and he failed to do what God wanted. His fear blinded him to the truth that his son's death had nothing to do with Tamar. They were just rotten sons being judged for their sin. So what you want to learn from this as a takeaway is don't let fear pressure you into rationalizing away righteous behavior. We can sometimes justify disobedience to the Lord, and it seems reasonable to us. Verses 12 through 19 tell us the years roll by and Shelah grew up and he's a man. And when it was obvious to Tamar that Judah wasn't going to give his son to her, she took matters into her own hands. She has a deep sense of responsibility to produce an heir. So she pretends to be a prostitute and lures her father-in-law into having sexual relations with her. She has to have some sort of indication that she thinks or knows this plan will work, meaning she knows something about the nature of Judah's character enough to recognize that if she executes this plan, she's likely going to be successful. So that speaks a little bit to the type of person who Judah might be. But anyway, Judah's wife had died, and he goes to shear sheep in a place called Timnah. She disguises herself as a temple prostitute, and to pay for her services, he promises to send her a young goat. Again, with the goats in this chapter, in this book, it's crazy. Anyway, she is crafty, and she wants some type of pledge. She needs collateral, so she asks for his seal, cord, and staff. The seal and cord would have been worn around his neck, and the staff is his walking stick, which would have had identifying marks on it, which were recognizable and distinctive to him and others. It's like she's asking for his credit card, passport, and license. He gives them to her, and they sleep together, and she conceives. Verses 20 through 26 tell us, when Judah sent the goat to her by way of his friend, no one knew of her, so he kind of just lets the matter rest. But 3 months later, he's told Tamar is pregnant. And he condemns her to death as a harlot. Let her be burned, Judah says. What hypocrisy. She must have figured something like this would happen. So she produces the evidence that Judah is responsible for the pregnancy. Verse 25, when she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law saying, by the man to whom these belong, I am with child. And she said, please determine whose these are, the seal and cord and staff. This had to be a bit of a punch in the gut to Judah. He acknowledges them, and he says, she has been more righteous than I because I did not give her to Shelah, my son, and he never knew her again. He's humbly admitting his guilt, and her death sentence is rescinded. It seems this is a turning point in his life, and he's convicted of his sin. God was not responsible for this immoral and incestuous relationship, but he used this situation to bring about his will, which was Judah's messianic line continuing through Tamar. Verses 27 through 30 tells us Tamar gives birth to twin boys, and in the birth process, one son, Zerah, thrust his hand out first, and the midwife put a scarlet thread on his wrist, but then he pulled back. Can we say ouch? And the other son, Perez, forces his way past Zerah and was born first. His name means breaking forth, and it's this boy and his line that would become the family tree for Jesus of Nazareth. The timeless principle of this story is to reveal God as sovereign. And by Tamar being in the line of Christ as a Canaanite woman, this gives us hope that Christ receives sinners. All are invited to him for salvation. Fornicators, deceivers, Christ forgives all who come to him in repentance and faith. So make sure nothing is keeping you from Christ. You aren't too sinful for him. Tamar is a living illustration of the grace of God that saves those who have been rejected by others. His grace reaches out to all. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your word, and thank you for all the application that these chapters give us, and I pray that you would help us to live out what you want us to do. And I just thank you for the ladies who are here to study, and I pray that you would just give us a blessed week. In your name, amen.